White Rocket Entertainment.
And here is Campbell retreating. He shoots a pass. Bo Jackson has it. He dives. He is down at the goal line. Inches short of a touchdown. Oh, he was ever so close. Fourth and goal to go for Auburn. And I see the Auburn players are asking for quiet, Pat. Nobody split. Give the Bo. Up and over. And in it, I believe. Touchdown. Touchdown, Auburn. Well, that was sure second effort by Bo Jackson. He just got hit behind the line of scrimmage. Everybody knew what was coming. Alabama knew what was coming. Bo Jackson just on sure effort got it in.
Jeremy Henderson of the War Eagle Reader.
I was in a band that was basically a punk band. They didn't like that I was singing about Auburn football, but that's what I was singing about. And I was like, I'm the singer, so screw it. I'm singing about what I want to sing about. And I'm singing about like the 1969 Iron Bowl, the 72 Iron Bowl. I'm singing about 11-0. It was such like this huge deal. And it was so, I was just like, this is like who I am. Like I straight up felt like some sort of, and I mean, still do to a certain extent, some sort of like mission almost to celebrate this. And that's just weird. I'm not even like almost like proud of that almost. I mean, it's almost like a disease, you know, but it's like, here it is. And you, I mean, I'm making with it, you know, I'm living the best life I can with it. So I don't know. It's strange. And I totally wonder, like, is it like this for other fan bases, for other people? I mean, for even other Auburn fans, but is it like this for other, do people at Vanderbilt feel this way? Do people at Kentucky feel this way? Does UCLA, I mean, can you imagine somebody at UCLA feeling this way about like their football team? I don't know.
No.
I can't.
This is We Believe, a lifetime in the Auburn family. Part 2, Sugar Sweet, Pat Dye, 1982 through 1983.
Our first episode was more of an introduction. What it was like to be an Auburn fan in the 1970s and at the turn of the decade, just before Pat Dye arrived. This episode, we turn back to 1982, a year of hope, a year of promise and excitement and building toward what we were sure was great things. Here's Reynolds Wolf.
Barfield was a great man. There's no question about it. Offensive coordinator, if memory serves, was Shug. So he had the pedigree, he had the DNA, but the results just weren't there. And although I think the players fought hard, there was something lacking. Patrick Fane Dye took care of that. And the thing about Patrick Fane Dye is you had someone at the time Alabama was looking, when Bear Bryant drifted away from Alabama football, the person in the Southeastern Conference who was most Bear Bryant-esque was Patrick Fane Dye, which I'm sure actually caused the rivalry to just explode. That was one of many factors. But Pat Dye had swagger about him. I know it's a trite expression, but Pat Dye would walk into a stadium like a gunslinger. Fearless, edgy, insurmountable, unstoppable. He was the dude. And he had that South Georgia accent. He had a voice that was like molasses. Incredible. He was my John Wayne when I was a kid. He was. And approached the game with a fearlessness. And look at the guy. I mean, he had been in East Carolina for a short time, had been in Wyoming for a 6-5 season, and then erupted on the plains. He came to the plains like Everest in Kansas. What a mark he made.
Jeremy Henderson again.
I mean, to me, Pat Dye was God, basically, growing up. Pat Dye, to me, having a coach like that, and I mean, when Bowden was let go or fired or resigned or whatever happened with that, I had kind of lost. It was my freshman year or sophomore year of college, and I had kind of, don't tell anyone, I had kind of sort of backslidden, I guess, in terms of my zeal for the sport from my, you know, getting into music and girls, you know, in high school and everything, come down to college, and which was really into the college experience. So we'd go to a game or two, but wasn't, you know, like super up on. I couldn't have like named you the starting lineup or something. Again, I feel awful for it. It's my great shame. But when Bowden left, now I didn't know really all of the details behind it, but I remember like talking to some people. My dad called me to let me know. And I was like, oh, that's awful. Because for me, that 93 season was just this, you know, gift from God. And Bowden had, you know, was obviously God's, you know, messenger. And this was this, I mean, it was this amazing thing. And how could anybody, I mean, he was our coach, right? And Pat Dye taught me, I mean, it was, you didn't question, the idea of questioning a coach, for me, as somebody growing up under Pat Dye, like, I never, that was, you didn't do that. Or something, you know what I mean? It would have been like a soldier questioning, I don't know, like a general or something. I don't know. It was just so weird to me to think that somebody wouldn't want like our coach to be there, which sounds crazy now, given all the drama and given all the past and the history and everything. But I was just actually, as an adult, completely baffled at the idea that somebody wouldn't be like 100% behind a coach. And that's because of Pat Dye, because that's who I grew up with. And it was like, the only reason Pat Dye left was because of this outside force. You know what I mean? It was something that came, and it was his health, or it was, you know, the scandal and yada yada. And so it was like forces, evil forces had come and taken Pat Dye from us. But the idea that somehow within that people would want the coach to be gone, I was just, it was blew my mind. And that was all coming just from this childlike faith in Pat Dye, who, that was what a coach was to me. And Pat Dye won football games, and Pat Dye was a badass, and Pat Dye coughed, and Pat Dye said it like it was, and it was so great. I mean, I felt like we were in the best hands in the business, you know, bar none. And I just had no, there was nothing beyond him, like, in my mind. I mean, it was like we were growing up in that era. We just didn't, in my mind, like, we didn't lose.
Linebacker Greg Carr.
And I think everybody who came in with my class, we came to Auburn because we wanted to go to Auburn. I don't think we're thinking about conference championships or national championships. And when Coach Dye came in, he instilled that. And, you know, now something we really believe in.
Coach Dye.
You're talking about a little small country town where there's 18,000 students and all they got is each other. And it's a setting where there's a lot of warmth and close relationships between the student body and the players and each other and the town and the community. And it's just one big happy family.
So, John, where we left off last time was in 1981, when Auburn had brought in Pat Dye from Wyoming, one of Bear's boys from back at Alabama in the old days. We went into that in some detail last time. And Dye had come in and gone 5-6, but the six that we had lost... The six we lost were Wake Forest, at Tennessee, at Nebraska, and that team building up toward being a juggernaut, Mississippi State, Georgia, at Georgia, and Alabama in Birmingham. But we had beaten TCU, beaten LSU, beaten Georgia Tech, beat Florida, beat North Texas, and the Tennessee loss was close, the Nebraska loss was relatively close, the Wake Forest loss was close. All the losses were pretty darn close. We even led Alabama 17-16 late in the second half before they, you know, used their depth to pull away at the end. So do you remember the 81 season and coming out of it and knowing we had a freshman named Bo Jackson coming in? And how much do you remember actually knowing or thinking about what 82 could be and would be? And how soon did you know it was going to be a pretty darn good year and things were going in the right direction?
I don't, you know, I was too young to have that kind of preseason expectations. You know, I'm sure I got the Sports Illustrated College Football preview and read it before that season, but I don't think I had the same level perception about how good we were and how good we were going to be. And when you described it like the season before, like that, though, it made me think of the Jimmy Johnson description of kind of the four stages where you lose big, you lose close, you win close, and you win big.
Yeah.
And Auburn had moved to losing close.
Yes.
To good teams. And now we were ready to move to winning close against good teams.
That's good.
And that's kind of a segue from 81 to 82. Personally, I didn't. I'm sure my parents did have perception that, you know, Bo Jackson was, you know, but I knew that, you know, people were more optimistic, and that the team felt pretty good headed, you know, in 82 than they did in the years before that.
Well, let's pause for a second to talk about how we knew what we knew back then, because understand that it was a very different world, right?
The dark ages.
Yeah, probably 80% of what we knew came from like the Birmingham News or the Montgomery Advertiser. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I never saw either one of those papers ever during this time. We got the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Oh, God, I'm sorry.
And, you know, back then there was a good bit of college football information in it for a paper at that time. There was pre-internet. Auburn was on TV like four times a year.
Right.
And, you know, we, as I said in the before, we went to the home games, and I went to most of them with my family. But we listened to the radio broadcast. We had an away game. And, you know, I'd read the program. Yeah, that's more of how I knew the roster, when I'd go to a home game and actually, you know, buy a program for some guy on the side of the road and read it. But no, like, there was no internet. There was no podcast. There was no sources of information about the depth chart.
No message boards, no Facebook groups, no Twitter, none of that. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't think about that you were in Atlanta, right? We, you know, in Sylacauga, my granddad got the Birmingham News every day. And so the Sunday Birmingham News would come in, and it would have the sports section, especially on a Sunday after an Auburn or Alabama, you know, a Saturday football game. And it would always, if the Auburn game was bigger, they might put us at the top of the sports page. Usually the default was the Alabama game would be at the top and Auburn would be second. You know, if Alabama was playing Louisiana Monroe or whoever back then and we were playing Florida State, we'd probably be at the top. There were sometimes they'd split it down the middle, which was interesting. They have Alabama and Auburn kind of vertically split down the middle. Just a few times they did that. Like we played Florida State in 85 when Alabama was playing Tennessee. And so it was like each got half the front page, which was kind of funny. The other sources of information you had, like I say, inside the Auburn Tigers magazine. And, and what's his name that writes for them, was writing way back then in the early 80s. I remember seeing his
byline. Mark Murphy.
I remember seeing Mark Murphy's bylines on Inside the Auburn Tigers articles in 1982, in 83. So he's been around a long time, bless his heart. And he has really dedicated his life to reporting on Auburn sports, and that's really amazing. But, yeah, Inside the Auburn Tigers. And you had, like, your network of people around the state. I don't know about Atlanta. I assume you had your own network over there that your dad and your mom were probably tight with or whatever. But there was that network of people around Alabama for sure. You know, in every business, people that would travel around. And so they all would share and swap information, stuff that was Xerox, photocopied of information and all, little joke things and all. I just remember seeing all that stuff that would come through. Like where my stepmother worked at a lumber company, you know, and she would get stuff from the traveling people that would come through. A lot of them were former Auburn or Alabama players, and what they were doing now were being like sales representatives for companies, you know. So there was like this whole informal network out there. It was like the internet before the internet, of people that just traveled around and shared information on the programs. So that was what we had. And so we knew a little bit about what was coming in 82. We knew we had a player named Bo Jackson. I don't think we need to go into the whole background story of Bo Jackson. I think most people know the deal where, you know, he was a fairly well-regarded running back at McAdory in Birmingham, but he was not really seen as like the second coming of Herschel Walker or anything. You know what I mean? I mean, how would you describe how Bo was regarded before he came to Auburn?
I mean, I think he was a high-profile recruit, but not like one of the top 10 recruits in the country back then. And I think it was, again, it was the dark ages of recruiting services, too, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And people knew he was a good player. But it was, again, there was no scout 24/7, any of that kind of stuff. I mean, people, you know, they had an informal network of people, including, like, my dad was part of the informal network for Auburn for high school players in that area, where he would go and watch games or whatever and then tell them about people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how it was. Like, it was there wasn't, you know, instant game film of these players and stuff. And Bo was highly regarded, but also nobody knew, like, how good he would be and how good he could become from moving from high school to college.
Here's Reynolds again.
Vincent Jackson. The thing about Bo Jackson was, every time I remember watching Bo Jackson in 1982 and again in 1983, and the thing about him is, you didn't want to leave. You didn't want to go to the bathroom. You didn't want to take a sip of your drink. You didn't want to do anything that would distract your attention from the field, because odds were you were going to see something happen on the field that you may never see again, and you certainly had never seen before. And the thing about Bo, especially when Dye went from the wishbone to the I formation, and you had Pat Washington on a toss sweep, send it out to Bo, it was like watching a Saturn V rocket explode up the sidelines. Unstoppable, and obliterating anything and everything in his path.
So we still had Lionel James left out of all the great running backs of the late 70s into 1980 or so, in 81. We still had Lionel James. The rest were all gone by this point to the NFL and or the USFL at some point in there. We had Lionel, and we needed a quarterback. And Pat Dye kind of looked around and tried out a few people and ended up picking who was, I think, like our third-string quarterback the year before, little old scrawny Randy Campbell. Because Campbell was never going to be a pro-style quarterback. He was never going to be like a run-and-shoot quarterback or anything like that. But one thing Randy Campbell could do was make good decisions on the option. And he was very good at ball security. You know, he was a good field leader, and he could make good decisions, and he held onto the ball. And that's what Pat Dye wanted in a quarterback. When you're now running the wishbone, the triple option wishbone, and the quarterback's job is to hand the ball to Bo Jackson and Lionel James, you just need somebody that will make good decisions about when to do that, which is basically every play, right?
Every play you keep it is failure.
Exactly. So although Randy was not too bad at doing like little quarterback sneaks for a couple of yards for a touchdown or something, he could do that.
He could.
You always worried he's going to get killed because he seems so scrawny, but he did that. And so you had Lionel James, you had Randy Campbell, and here comes the true freshman Bo Jackson onto campus. The defense was getting a lot tougher. Dye had really hardened that defense up in 81. Remember, we said before that the main liability that those great offensive Auburn teams in the late 70s and 1980 had was they could score 40 points, but they'd give up 45. So Dye was really going to build up our defense, and he started bringing in those big defensive linemen and bringing in some fast defensive backs, you know, Kevin Porter types, eventually, you know, Carlo Cheatham and those kind of guys, and bringing in guys like Bobby Humphrey, and was it Doug Smith early on that we had?
Yes.
You know, those big old guys. Big old guys on the front line. And so the defense was getting nasty. And, of course, this is when we start becoming I know that Alabama was linebacker U in the 80s, but honestly, Auburn was not far behind Alabama. Alabama maybe had two or three bigger names by the time the decade was over. But I would argue that Auburn's linebackers, top to bottom, were every bit as good as Alabama's during the 80s. What do you remember about that?
100%. The defense got really, really good during this time.
Yeah, they did.
And better coached, better players, better schemes. And also, we were running the wishbone in offense, so we were limiting possessions. You know, taking advantage of, you know, putting pressure on the other team, and they were kind of desperate where they had the ball to make something happen. Because, again, we had a wishbone offense. We also had Bo Jackson, so we had scoring opportunities.
Yeah.
So it was really, really exciting to see the defense, you know, become a force.
Yeah, it's a good point, too, that the offense we were running did several things. You can see why Dye went to it, because it did several important things. It kept the defense off the field for long periods of time if you could make first downs, because it was not other than when Bo was going to turn an 80-yard run, it was not an offense that was going to go out there. I mean, if it got off the field in a hurry, it was because they punted. Otherwise, it would stay out there and stay out there. And it would take a long time, usually, to score unless they were in a hurry. And they really only threw the ball when they had to, because, you know, Dye famously said, I'm sure he was quoting somebody, but Dye famously said, when you throw the football, three things can happen and two of them are bad. So he didn't like to throw the ball very much. He liked to run. And so, yeah, one of the things that running the wishbone did was give the defense plenty of rest and let them stay fresh. Of course, he also was big about rotating, you know, that defensive line, keeping them fresh too. I remember them always talking about how we were just constantly shuffling defensive linemen in and out almost every play, and they were always fresh. The other thing it did was it gave a team where the offensive line was still kind of growing and trying to come into its own. You know, one of the things the option does is let you replace power at the point of attack with numbers. So if your guy isn't as good as their guy at the point of attack, you just have two guys against their one guy at the point of attack. That's kind of the idea a lot of times of the triple option, is you're trying to move players around so that you outnumber the defense at the point of attack. Now, that's why, you know, within a few years, the wishbone really stops working as a top flight philosophy, because defenses got so fast that you couldn't really outnumber them at the point of attack for very long anymore. They'd get people, you know, they would have bodies to the point of attack very quickly as soon as they figured out what was going on, and you kind of have to start moving toward more NFL pro style defenses, really. But yeah, the wishbone was really an interesting thing during this time, and it helped Auburn based on what personnel we had on offense and on defense. We also had really good special teams. I think this was the first year that we had our punter, Lewis Colbert. I know that by 85 he was an all-SEC punter, but I guess 82 is his freshman year. And do you remember our field goal kicker here in this period?
I remember his kicks in the Sugar Bowl the next year.
The greatest kicker in
Del Greco.
The greatest golfer in NFL history. Yes, Al Del Greco. And so we had good special teams. So we had, you know, let me put it this way. There's been several seasons over the years that Auburn, the personnel, when you first glance at it, doesn't seem that impressive. But when you break it down by position, you go, ooh, that's a great player at, you know, running back. Oh, that's a great player at linebacker. That's a great player at defensive end. Oh, that's a great player at kicker. And, you know, suddenly you realize we didn't have a ton of depth during a lot of these years. It's just like the same way with 93. You know, that 93 team at first glance didn't seem that impressive. But when you start looking at each position, you find like an all-SEC guy at almost every position. And you find guys that went on and played in the NFL at almost every position. So that's kind of an Auburn trademark, is that for many years we wouldn't have like the depth of a, you know, of a Miami or Alabama nowadays, but we'd have like that one really great player at almost every position on the field that could really make a difference as long as they didn't get hurt. So let's look at that 82 season real quick. Here's the first thing that jumps out to me about the 82 season. The first six games we played at home.
It's true. And the other thing that's weird looking at the 82 season is the non-conference games.
Mm-hmm.
Like we only played six conference games.
That's right. Out of 11.
So we played five non-conference games. So the non-conference opponents in 82 were Wake Forest, Southern Miss, Nebraska, Georgia Tech, Rutgers.
Yeah. Isn't that a strange combination? See, that was something that people take for granted now, is that we play eight conference games instead of six. And, of course, I want us to go to nine.
Sure.
And so we can keep coming up to Missouri every couple of years. And yet, we played six conference games and five non-conference games for a total of 11 back then. There was no SEC championship game. So you played your 11 games, your six SEC games, your five non-SEC games, and a bowl game if you were lucky. And it's hard to imagine, too. You played six SEC games, but you were playing in a 10-team conference, and so you make the seventh team yourself, so that means there's three teams that you were not playing every year. Now, it rotated around a little bit. You had some you played every year, and some you didn't. Like, so, for example, we played Tennessee, at least in the SEC, because we played Georgia Tech every year, too, as an out-of-conference.
Mm-hmm.
But in the SEC, we played Tennessee, Mississippi State,
Florida,
Georgia, Alabama every year. Back then, it's hard to imagine. You know, the only other team that we didn't play every year that would have made it harder is if we'd played LSU instead of Mississippi State.
Mm-hmm. Or we played Kentucky in 82 instead of, you know, we could have played LSU instead.
Or Ole Miss or Vanderbilt. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we went 5-1 in our first six games at home. Then we went to Mississippi State and won there. So we were actually 6-1 to start that season. And I remember Bo Jackson debuted against either Wake Forest or Southern Miss. I'm not sure if he played in the Wake Forest game or not. I know I remember him playing in the Southern Miss game for sure. And I remember, oh, I didn't mention there's one other source of information we had besides Inside the Auburn Tigers and the newspapers and the radio. And that was when the call-in show, the coaches' call-in shows were big, because that was, again, one of your few sources of information. The other source of information was the coaches' show.
Oh, yes, the coaches' review show.
The Auburn Football Review, yeah.
The Auburn Football Review with Coach Pat Dye is brought to you by Colonial Bank, Bank with the Future, and by Snapper, the leader in quality lawn care equipment. And by Farm Bureau Insurance and Federated Guarantee Life, available from your Farm Bureau agent. And by Godfather's Pizza's new hot slice, pizza by the slice for lunch. And by your local Coca-Cola bottler. Your host is Phil Snow.
Yeah, those were big because like you said, we were only on TV a couple of times a year. So you watched the Auburn Football Review with Phil Snow and whoever the coach was. In some cases, that was the only time you got to see any highlights from that. That was even before SportsCenter.
Yep.
So unless
this is before ESPN and cable TV came along.
Yeah.
And if you were at the stadium, if you got up to get a Coke or go to the mm-hmm. restroom or something, and you missed a Bo Jackson 80-yard run, that doesn't mean that a highlight was going to be everywhere.
No.
But if you watch the coaches show in the middle of the week, they would definitely show it.
Yeah, they'd have the shows on Sunday and then maybe show them again in other markets. We would get them on Channel 12 out of Montgomery, and I think maybe Channel 6 out of Birmingham would show them on Sunday. I guess the film was still wet when they were showing them, you know, because they had put them together overnight or early that morning. They'd record them early Sunday morning, and then they would show them at like noon or 1 or 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, I remember. I think that was it, or maybe early Sunday morning. I'm not sure which. But they had them on really quick. I know that. And Bear Bryant's show was an hour long. You got an hour of, I've been talking to the mamas and the papas and the blah, 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 blah. Well, no, Coach Bryant, it's actually so-and-so. Yeah, shut up. bourbon, Coca-Cola, Frito-Lay, smoke a cigarette. That was what you got from his show. But an hour of that. But you got a half an hour of Phil Snow talking to Pat Dye. And this was before Phil Snow would be like, so, Coach, tell us about that game against Alabama. What? Bless old Pat Dye's heart. Later on, he had that physical problem that made him cough his way through every interview. But back then, he was still young and healthy.
To reinforce your point about the value of the coaches show,
yeah.
Auburn did not appear on television during this season until October 30th.
Mm-hmm. And that's because we were 6-1 and going to number 9, going down to play at Florida. We were ranked. We were ranked, and we were going to Florida Field, and we were on ABC. So this is before Jefferson Pilot. This is before ESPN.
Before the CBS contract.
Yeah, all of that. That's right. So we lost at Florida, and this is an interesting game at Florida because it was 17-19. I believe this is a game where Florida was mad that we had beaten them the year before on a field goal, I think. And so they came out and they kicked a long field goal late to edge us 19-17. It was one of a series of very close, frustrating losses at Florida over the years. You know, we back in the 80s, you know, the Kerwin Bell game in 86 always jumps out as well when, you know, he was like in a wheelchair and rolled himself into the end zone. And that last, oh, God, it just...
I hate Kerwin Bell.
Oh, absolutely. He went to the Orlando Thunder in the WLAF, and I hated the Orlando Thunder. I hated them because of Kerwin Bell. So we were at this point. I need to mention one thing about that Nebraska game. On October the 2nd, we had gone to Nebraska the year before and lost a fairly close game, and so Nebraska came down and played at Auburn when we were ranked 20th. and they beat the snot out of us 41-7. But do you have any memories of that game and how we got the seven?
No.
I'm thinking, and correct me out there if I'm wrong, but my memory is that that seven was Bo running toward the end zone, and two big old Nebraska guys are standing on like the 1 yard line, shoulder to shoulder, to tackle him. And he does like this flip where first he's standing in front of them, upright. Next thing you know, his feet are straight up in the air and his head is like touching the tops of their helmets. And then he's standing upright behind them in the end zone.
That sounds like a Bo Jackson story right there.
I mean, everything but the bamf from when he teleported like Nightcrawler into the end zone. You know what I'm saying? So those Nebraska guys are like, where'd he go? I think that's how we scored. Because it was Bo, so it had to have been 82 because it wasn't 81. So anyway, okay, we beat Rutgers 30-7 at home. And number one Georgia comes into Auburn. By the way, John and I haven't done a ton of research for this because the whole point of this is, you know, the whole point of this series is what it felt like and what it was like to be Auburn fans over the years. That's kind of where we're going with all this. We're looking at Auburn history, and we're touching on all these moments where we were up and then we were down. It's like we ought to just call this the roller coaster, you know, because that's what Auburn fandom is like. But we're doing this basically to show what we remember and how vivid it is in our memories and everything, too. And this is the one, November 13th, number one Georgia came to Jordan-Hare. This was the 82 Georgia team that would go on to play in the national championship game. And so Georgia was number one. They were on their way to losing the Sugar Bowl, trying for their, you know, third attempt at a national championship after with Herschel. This was Herschel's last year of the three. So this is the game where you had Bo Jackson and Herschel Walker on the field together for the only time. And 74,900 people can say that they saw that firsthand. The rest of us wasn't even on television. Can you believe that?
That's insane now.
Yeah.
I mean, they were number one in the country at Auburn, Bo Jackson and Herschel, and it was not on TV.
Yeah. So at the time, we were like, well, of course it wasn't, but it's hard to imagine now. So this is the game where Auburn led, I believe, late, and we just couldn't hold Herschel, and he scores. And I have vague memories because there's been several times that we've narrowly lost to Georgia where we had the ball at the end and we just couldn't quite get it in the end zone. I think this is one where Randy Campbell was throwing the ball in the end zone on the last play, incomplete. And if he'd got it, we would have won.
Yes.
20-19. So we lose, and it's another one of those heartbreakers like the Tennessee loss the year before. But we played them so, so close. And Georgia knows, right? In their hearts, Georgia, every knowledgeable Georgia fan knows in their hearts that if you get Auburn when you're Georgia and a big point in your season, look out, right? Because our worst teams have given them nightmares in their best years. And then there's last year where we beat the snot out of them when they were number one. So Georgia is very, very used to getting their either brains beaten in by us or having their seasons ruined by us. It's not anything new. They've done it to us a couple of times, too. 2002. So that Georgia game, we lose. And at that point, we are, what, 7-3, I believe? Yeah. And we've got Alabama coming up in Legion Field. Now, John, this is the game against Alabama. It would end up being Bear Bryant's last regular season game, last Iron Bowl. Second and last time against Pat Dye, one and only attempt against Bo Jackson, and Alabama had beaten us 9 years in a row.
What? And because of that, yeah. And because it was Bears' last game, it was televised by ABC.
How much do you remember about the whole rigmarole around that game?
I remember, you know, thinking that for the first time in forever, it felt like we had a chance.
Yes, that's exactly,
you know,
what I was saying.
We had gotten our brains beat in for 9 years in a row, but this year, going into that game and during the game, it felt like it was more of an even matchup, but we had a real chance to win.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I remember having a conversation with a classmate in high school. This was my freshman year of high school. And I told you before, ever since kindergarten, Auburn had lost the Iron Bowl every year I was in school. And every year you were in school at this point, too. And I remember saying, I think this is the year. And I remember him smiling and saying, you're on the way, but I think it's going to take you one more year. There must have been some talk that, I mean, I don't think we knew Bear was going to retire, but I think a lot of people felt like it was coming, and maybe that was part of it. I mean, I'm not going to contradict you about ABC. They may have thought the same thing and figured, you know, let's do it. Or it may have just been that they had a contract to show multiple years of the Iron Bowl, regardless of the record. I don't know. But in any case, I think there was a sense that maybe this could be Bear's last Iron Bowl. And so the Alabama people were like, you know, Pat Dye's good. They would grudgingly admit that they liked Pat Dye. They admired him. They kind of wanted him to be the – they wanted him to replace Bear, you know, when Bear retired. And they said, you know, you guys may beat us. You're going to end that streak sooner or later, but we don't think it'll be this year. And I said, I think it's going to be this year. We'll see. And, man, what a battle it was. I mean, do you have specific memories of the plays in that game? Because I do for a game that was 36 years ago.
Only the ending, but so yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I just remember stuff like I remember Walter Lewis being their quarterback, and they had, what, Ken Coley, and they were kind of swapping back and forth between Coley and Lewis. Coley was more of an option runner, and Walter Lewis was more of like a passer, a little bit more mobile, more of a passer. Coley was the guy that would like take the snap, fake the handoff, and just quarterback sneak dive for 3 yards up the middle, like a kind of like a Tebow.
Wayne Madkin.
Okay. Whereas Walter Lewis was more like the, you know, take the snap, roll around, scramble a little bit, and throw a pass. And so they, you know, Bear was kind of switching back and forth between them all season. And Lewis ended up quarterbacking most of this game and had a pretty good game. But I remember we got a couple of key turnovers. I think we intercepted him a couple of times. And I remember one of our defensive backs, who wasn't particularly fast, caught a ball in midair. There was like a run. The Alabama running back went into the pile, and the ball just popped straight up. I think it was Tim Drinkard that took the ball out of the air and just ran back like 70 yards the other way. He got caught from behind, and I don't remember if we scored or not. Maybe he just got a field goal. But I remember it was pretty close at halftime. And then we came out in the second half and hung in there and hung around and finally got the ball on that last drive with just a couple of minutes to go and got down to the goal line. Remember, on third down, we were on like the 10 or 12 yard line on third down, but we had to, it was third and goal. And Campbell threw a little screen pass in the flat to Bo, and Bo got down to like the 1 yard line, and it's fourth and goal at the one. And tell the folks that don't know what happened next, because you know.
After we talk about this, you have to talk about Legion Field and yes. Why the game was there.
Yes.
But at this point in the game, you know, Bo Jackson was the man, and the key was what's he going to do? Is he going to go left? Is he going to go right? Is he going to go up the middle? And they handed the ball to him, and Bo went over the top and over the top into the end zone and scored the winning points, and Auburn won 23-22.
That's right. And Alabama got the ball back and had a chance to do something. And you just, after all those 9 years of seeing Alabama always pull it out at the end, if they didn't just trample us, it was just absolute terror knowing that they're going to drive right down the field and kick a field goal or score a touchdown and win. In fact, the way things had gone the last few years, it was 23-22. I was pretty much convinced they were going to go down and score two touchdowns and make it look like they kicked our brains in again, because that's what usually would happen. We would be leading. We would be leading in the fourth quarter, and they'd score two quick touchdowns at the end, and it looked like they killed us. That happened over and over and over in the late 70s and early 80s. So, yeah, Alabama got the ball back, and I remember Dye yelling and screaming, rush three, because remember what defensive formation we used through most of the 80s? We used a 3-4. We had those three, that we have a nose guard and two ends, and we'd have two inside linebackers and two outside linebackers. And that was the formation that Dye used and Wayne Hall used through most of the well, Frank Orgel, and then it was Wayne Hall, that we used through most of the 80s. And so he was saying, rush three, drop eight. And we had eight men in coverage, and they still managed to, like, sack and intercept Walter Lewis and run the clock out, and we won.
on fourth down and six. Plenty of time to throw. Lewis now throwing over the middle. It is intercepted! It is intercepted by Bob Harris! Bob Harris at the 30-yard line with an Auburn interception. Took it away from the intended receiver, Turner. And Auburn has the football with a minute and 45 seconds to go and a one-point lead over the Alabama Crimson Tide. As a sea of orange and blue celebrants are tearing down the goalposts in this monumental victory, ladies and gentlemen, as the Auburn Tigers have defeated the Alabama Crimson Tide by the score of 23-22. Sullivan, you didn't think we could do it. I didn't think we could do it. We have done it.
And that was so awesome. And Pat Dye was crying because, of course, he loved the Bear because the Bear had given him his career, basically, and given him an opportunity. And I understand that. And he went out and hugged him at the middle of the field. And I remember the headline, the Birmingham News, one of them was Auburn ends a 9-year wait. And the other one was Pat Dye and a tear for the Bear. And I wasn't cynical about that. I know that a lot of Auburn fans want to be cynical about all that, and I totally understand it, and that's fine. It's Alabama. Be all you want. But, just from Pat Dye's perspective, Bear Bryant was a guy that Dye tremendously respected, had given him his chance to start his career and gotten him going. I mean, you had to respect somebody. He was a legend. So I understand that. And then, of course, they went out and tore the goalpost down. And I'm in favor of any dismantling that happens at Legion Field, especially when we do it. It needed dismantling.
So why do you have those feelings about Legion Field? Let's talk about that. The location of this game and many other games in the series.
On Graymont Avenue, the iron girders on Graymont. The deal was, and I'll throw a few things in and you add as you want. The deal was that back then, Auburn's stadium, Jordan-Hare, was only beginning to expand out to be as big as any other stadium in the state. It had been smaller. I wrote a whole history of the stadium, which we can get into later. Auburn was seen as not having a big enough stadium for big teams to come in, and Auburn was seen as not having enough places for people to stay, not enough hotels, not enough accommodations. I know that today that seems unbelievable, but back as recently as the late 80s, it was thought that Auburn didn't have enough hotel rooms available, or restaurants, or restrooms. If 30,000 people are going to come into town for a sporting event, where were they going to use the bathroom? A couple of gas stations and a restaurant. That was about it. A McDonald's. I mean, there weren't the physical accommodations. But Tuscaloosa didn't have much better. Bryant-Denny was not much bigger. And so Alabama played all their big games in Legion Field. They'd play like a Rutgers in Tuscaloosa, but they'd play Penn State or Notre Dame or Georgia or, whoever in Legion Field, because it was like 75,000 capacity, and they played the Iron Bowl there. It was the agreement they made. It's so funny how it was their home stadium for all their big games, and yet magically when Auburn played them there, it was a neutral site.
It was a neutral site where the ushers all wore Alabama hats.
Yeah, and eventually there was a statue of Bear Bryant outside.
And they played four games a year there, but it was neutral.
Right. And the only thing that was neutral about it was they would divide the tickets down the middle, so half the stadium was supposed to be Auburn and half would be Alabama. But in bad years, and we had a few as we've been talking about, it would be, three quarters Alabama and a quarter Auburn for our home game.
Yep.
Like we were Vanderbilt or something. So Pat Dye understood very quickly he needed to get the home games moved out of Legion Field and down to Auburn. And he started a process of expanding our facilities, expanding Jordan-Hare, expanding all the other infrastructure around it. It's not just the stadium. You got to have a hotel and conference center. You got to have hotel rooms. You got to have restrooms. You got to be able to accommodate that many people, that much traffic coming in. Where did people park when they went to Legion Field, John?
In people's yards and driveways.
Yep.
And stuff.
Yep. Yeah, they would stand out there and rent you their yard for like $5. And you just hoped your car was still there when you left the game. I can think of several times, not just for Iron Bowls, that I went up to Birmingham to something in Legion Field, and I'd leave my car in somebody's yard and just hope that everything went okay.
Well, and also when it was the Iron Bowl, you ended up in a situation where you came out, you walk back to your car, and you were intermixed with the fans of the other team. You know, and it was 50-50. So you may be walking down some street as it's getting dark in Birmingham into some guy's driveway, and it's like, you know, you and some Alabama fans.
Yeah, that's true. It's one thing to be walking out of an on-campus stadium past, at the worst, dorms where a frat guy is going to yell at you. It's another thing to be walking out of Legion Field and going through the slums where God knows who might be yelling at you that has nothing to do with the game and, you know, just wants your wallet and your watch and your keys, you know. So, yeah, it was just not a good environment. Nobody really liked it except the city of Birmingham. The stadium was never in very good shape. The light bulbs always burn out. I remember the Birmingham News columnist would constantly say, just for God's sake, right, Notre Dame's coming in to play Alabama. Can we put some light bulbs in? And they never would. They never did. It was always just burned out light bulbs. You get part of a number. It's kind of, and yet, with all that, do you remember what it said across the bottom of the upper deck in Legion Field?
No.
Birmingham, football capital of the South. Oh, boy. And I remember one Auburn columnist saying, you know, when Auburn and Alabama was a big game and was played in Legion Field, that was the one time a year, maybe, that you could actually say that was true. And that's valid, I think. But so we beat Alabama in Legion Field in 82 to cap off the regular season. And we get to go off on December 18th. We hadn't been in a bowl game in years because we'd either had bad seasons or else we were on probation. We talked about that already. So this is cool. We got to go down to Orlando and play in the Tangerine Bowl against Boston College with their quarterback, Doug Flutie.
The year before the Doug Flutie Hail Mary against Miami.
This is 2 years before.
2 years.
Yeah, 84 was when he threw the Hail Mary and won the Heisman Trophy. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. And so this was Flutie, I guess, as a sophomore. We played him, and it was on, there was an ESPN by now. This was very early days for ESPN. And it was on there, but I don't remember watching it. I think I remember listening to it. I may not have even, I guess I didn't have ESPN.
We didn't have cable.
Yeah, we didn't have cable yet. Nope. 15 people saw that on ESPN, so I was listening to it on the radio.
Boston College returning to the bowl scene after a 40-year absence led by the sophomore quarterback Doug Flutie. The Tigers of Auburn rely on the potent wishbone attack. Freshman running sensation Bo Jackson. You've got a couple of potent offensive teams meeting tonight in the Tangerine Bowl on ESPN. ESPN's College Football 82, a special bowl edition. Tonight, the Tangerine Bowl from Orlando, Florida. The Boston College Eagles taking on Auburn. Hello, I'm Bob Lee. Welcome once again to our Holiday Bowl Bonanza. Just keeps on happening. And tonight, live from the Tangerine Bowl in Orlando, it is the Tangerine Bowl Classic. Boston College in Auburn. Capacity crowd expected this evening for the matchup between BC and Auburn. Sam Rosen and Paul McGuire bring you the play-by-play this evening. Let's check in now for a few pregame thoughts. Gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Bob Lee. Paul McGuire, Boston College and Auburn. Boston College with a multiple offense that Auburn has to stop.
This is going to be a problem. They've got to get to Flutie. Flutie, the quarterback, is the key to it. Only 5'10", great football player, Sam. What Auburn has to do, number one, is rush this guy, blitzes. And the other thing I think we're going to be surprised at, we're going to see Auburn go with five defensive backs early in the ball game, not on third down, but maybe on first down.
Okay, for Boston College, the problem is dealing with the wishbone offense. They haven't faced it all season long.
Yeah, the wishbone offense is a tough offense. Now, what they try to do with wishbone is wear a team down. If this is a close game going into the fourth quarter, you got to give the nod to Auburn for one reason. They're going to wear your defense down and they're going to score on you.
Okay, stadium is packed. Lots of excitement. We'll be set to go in just a little bit with the Tangerine Bowl. Now back to you, Bob.
Okay, Sam, that kickoff just a few moments away. And as we continue on the pregame show for the Tangerine Bowl, our special bowl edition, they tied Clemson. Among the highlights for Auburn this year, they did play a very good game, lost at Nebraska, played tough with Georgia for 60 minutes, but for the first time in 10 years, pinned a loss on Alabama. Let's take a look now at Boston College. They have an offense led by the young and the small quarterback, 5'10 sophomore Doug Flutie, but he's got a heck of an arm. Here he finds receiver Scott Nizelik. Had an exceptional day in a losing effort against Penn State. The sophomore Flutie making his mark in 82, threw for 13 touchdowns. John Shane, the flanker back, pulled this one in. Flutie can run the ball as well. His bootleg here. Well, Pat Dye, the Auburn coach, knows what to expect.
Boston College is a worthy opponent. Got an outstanding football team. Coaching staff has done a great job. They play with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of confidence. They're a big, strong, physical football team on both sides of the ball and do a great job with the offense. Flutie, the little quarterback, is, you know, he's amazing. And, you know, it'll be a he'll make the bowl game a lot of fun for the Boston College people. I don't know how much fun he'll make it for Auburn people.
If you're rooting for Auburn this evening, you've got to be happy with this young man, freshman Bo Jackson, who's averaged 6 yards a carry, scored 9 touchdowns. Jackson has out of that Auburn wishbone attack. The other number 34, if you will, from the SEC. This was the big touchdown that he scored against Alabama for the upset victory, giving Auburn its bowl shot and the bowl bid. The other threat out of the wishbone for the War Eagles, the Tigers, junior Lionel James, who scored 7 touchdowns this year, averaging almost 7 yards a carry.
In defense, we've got to slow down a wishbone, which we haven't played against. Now, we understand how to play against it, but our players haven't recognized it that much, so that's going to be a challenge, too.
The wishbone is so mental because the actions and the reactions are so different than any other offense.
Well, you've got to have somebody on dive, somebody on quarterback, and somebody on pitch, and you can't say, well, I thought it was a dive, and then have the quarterback run forever. So it's a very disciplined approach you've got to have from a defensive standpoint.
And so Auburn won 33-26. I think Bo had a pretty good game. I don't remember all the details out of it. I mean, I guess we held Flutie in check, and we ended up number 18. Actually, we ended the season number 14, so not too bad.
No.
We ended third. We ended up tied for third in the SEC, believe it or not, with Vanderbilt. This was one of their decent years. They finished 8-4, 4-2 in the SEC.
Probably their peak.
Yeah. It was one of the last times they went to a bowl game, I think, before, you know, recently. But we ended up 4-2 and 9-3 overall. And I remember thinking 9-3 is pretty awesome. And the best thing about 9-3 is Alabama was 8-4.
Yeah.
So when Auburn beat Alabama in the Iron Bowl, that gave us a better season record once we won our bowl game. Because they won their bowl game too. I remember that was the one where they ended up beating Illinois in the Liberty Bowl, Bears' last game. So 82 ends, and there was this great buzz, right? There was this great buzz in the off season that we had a defense, we had a quarterback coming back who was a senior, we had these great running backs in Bo Jackson, Lionel James, and we would have Brent Fullwood as a freshman. We still had Collis Campbell and Kyle Collins. We had quite a few. We had good depth at running back. We may have still had Chris Woods at receiver. I can't remember. I know we were about to put Clayton Buford at receiver. We still had Del Greco at kicker. We had just good special teams all the way around. There was just tremendous optimism going into the 1983 season. And in the lead up to that season, two things that I want to mention here. One is less serious, but ends up being obviously very important, and that's that the schedule came out. And you look at the schedule that Auburn faced in 1983, and it just is it's just mind-boggling. Like, how did we end up with this schedule? And yet we won every game but one.
Mm-hmm.
We played, at the time, number 3 Texas, number 5 Florida, number 4 Georgia, number 7 Maryland with Boomer Esiason, number 19 Alabama, and then we end up playing number 8 Michigan,
and
we
that also doesn't include
at Tennessee
or Florida State,
at Georgia Tech, Mississippi State, at Kentucky, as well as Southern Mississippi. So, talk about a murderer's row! My goodness.
But I know I kept trying to remember who it was. Now I don't think it was Bill Conley, but somebody else did some historical analysis of team schedules, and I think this was rated like one of the toughest schedules in the history of college football.
No kidding! It had to be unbelievable. All right, so we'll get back to that schedule in a second as we look at it in a little more depth for a minute. But the other thing that happened, of course, in the offseason, there was so much buzz, there was so much excitement, and then in practice, Greg Pratt. I guess he was our starting fullback, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And he collapsed and died of the heat. And I feel like if it had happened just a few years later, it would have been a much bigger scandal. But this was still a time where you're coming out of the day and age where when football players would fall over dead It was bad, of course, and there was, you know, a lot of concern and worry, and it was a big story, but today it would be like a freaking scandal, you know, and people might even get fired and drastic rules changes and everything. Back then, it was just kind of like, it's a tragedy, and then you move on. Yes. I mean, you know what I mean? It just was a different time. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay how it actually was. I think that, you know, maybe there should have been a lot more, you know, reaction than even what I remember. And again, there wasn't much media back then either. There wasn't, you know, the message boards and the Twitter and everything now. What is your memory about that, and how do you feel about that?
I honestly had forgotten about that until we started preparing for this podcast. That happened prior to the 83 season. But I know, I mean, again, at the time, programs were more open, but at the same time, you know, there wasn't as much reach. A story like that wouldn't have legs, and it would, you know, it would just kind of, and people would try to be respectful towards the family and stuff, so it wouldn't get dragged on. But it's like, clearly that shouldn't have happened. And it was a time when, you know, we didn't take players' health as seriously. You know, you think back to the, you know, some of the people's thoughts at the time about the Junction Boys and some of that kind of silliness, like, yeah. You know, in terms of taking care of player safety and keeping players hydrated and the way we'd, you know, exercise and that kind of stuff was different back then.
Right.
So, but at the same time, like, it was, you know, it was a terrible tragedy that in some ways may have helped fuel this team and all the talent and potential they had.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we had a freshman fullback that stepped in and went on to be like our starting star fullback for 4 years in Tommy Agee, who went on to be a star for the Dallas Cowboys. And so, you know, at least the cupboard wasn't bare either in terms of football. And again, you hate to segue from a guy dying to football, but that's kind of how things went. I mean, you know, Greg Pratt had passed away, and the team mourned, and they pulled together, and they went out and had an amazing, one of the greatest seasons in Auburn history. And it's a season in some ways is similar to 2004 that we're building toward with this series, because in 2004 – Auburn made their way up to number three and could just never get past the top two. And in 1983, similarly, we ended up number three and could just never get past the top two. The problem was it was a different top two at the end, more or at least in a different order, and one of them was different than it had been than it was in 2004. So let me run down some of the 83 schedule and some of the highlights, and then we can talk about it. So they open up September 7th at home against Southern Miss, good old traditional opponent. Auburn used to play Southern Miss all the time, and won 24-3. And then came the one game. It's like every, you know, if you point to every Auburn season and that almost was, that's a frustration season. You know, I said earlier that for every silver lining Auburn season, there seems to be a dark cloud. Now, let me clarify one thing about that. You might say, what about 2010? There was no dark cloud. Oh, I beg to differ. We overcame the dark cloud that year, but starting the week, you know, before the Chattanooga game, there was a very big dark cloud hanging over the end of that season. So the Texas game, Texas was number three. Understand that in 1983, the two teams that were poised to dominate college football that year were Nebraska and Texas. Nebraska opened up the season in the kickoff classic in the Meadowlands in New Jersey against Penn State that had won the – yeah, it was Penn State in 82, right. So Penn State were the defending champions, and they opened up against Nebraska, and Nebraska polished them pretty good. So Nebraska was clearly number one. This was the year that Nebraska was considered the team of the century. This was supposed to be like the greatest team ever, this Nebraska team with Mike Rozier and all those great defensive players. And so this 1983 Nebraska team was supposed to be great, and then Texas was supposed to be like this – almost as good. That they were number three at the beginning of the year. I can't remember who was number two. But that Texas team was also supposed to be just a juggernaut, and we got them at home in week two from CBS's pregame show before the Texas game in 1983.
When Paul Bryant died this year, there was little argument that a legend had passed, but there were legacies as well. All those athletes he touched and all those coaches he taught. One he taught now is in the same line of work, a couple of hundred miles down the road at Auburn. He is Pat Dye, a Southern gentleman who now finds himself in the position of perhaps becoming another Alabama legend.
When the job came open at Auburn, I knew that it was a perfect setting for my background and for me.
Pat Dye grew up in the South. For the exception of a short stay in Wyoming, has always worked in the South. Quite frankly, he's quite comfortable with Southern ways. For that matter, he's quite comfortable with the Southern roads and highways. He is a well-traveled recruiter down here. Indeed, recruiting may be Pat Dye's number one asset. Some down here went so far to say Bear Bryant was a little worried about his former student coaching in the Southeastern Conference because Dye was such a good recruiter. Dye takes a more modest view.
There's so many football players here in this area that we live in. Quality high school players that come from quality high school programs. We're the luckiest coaches in the world that live here in this Southeast area.
In his 2 years at Auburn, Dye has already put together a program strong enough to place high in the rankings and early out credible enough to prove Auburn means business.
He's a great organizer. He's intelligent. He's an innovator.
He's a great coach.
Coach Dye is great. Coach Dye is going to make us all forget Bear Bryant.
If one word could describe Pat Dye, it might be work. He loves to work, loves to make people work, loves to watch them work, and loves to talk about work.
You're on a real work ethic down here, is that what you're...
Well, you know, Pat, I was a 190-pound guard. And, I couldn't even play football if it wasn't for work.
Perhaps the one athlete who personified Pat Dye's theory of working was Greg Pratt, who was a walk-on with no scholarship, who earned himself a top position on the team.
Touchdown Pratt. To the fullback, Greg Pratt. Beautiful run.
Tragically, Pratt collapsed during a preseason session in what is still referred to as a freak accident. He died of a heart attack. So, how did Pat Dye get his team through this ordeal? Work.
I think that our players and our coaches, assistant coaches, did a great job of working through that time period and not losing sight of our goals and realizing that, you know, that's what Greg would have wanted the team and the coaches to do.
The great football teams improve when you win.
Coach Dye seems to be settling into this job quite nicely. While his contract calls for a $58,000 yearly salary, the extras are staggering. A radio TV show deal, commercials, two cars, and this $410,000 home in Auburn. He will keep all this if he stays 14 years. He plans to do this and become the kind of teacher Bear Bryant was, but with his own work methods and style. And so far, it seems to be working.
We know what it takes to win, and we know that we're going to have to pay the price to get it done. And he's given us the faith to pay the price and believing that all the good things are going to happen to us and the goals that we've set will be reached.
I asked Coach just how long he plans to stay at Auburn, and he said he plans to help raise his grandchildren there. And you know, Brent, with the kind of schedule he's got this season, it might seem like a lifetime. He's got Tennessee next week, Florida State, Kentucky, and at the end of the season, Georgia and Alabama back-to-back.
And we lost 7-20. It's one of those handful of games as an Auburn fan you wish you could just go back in time and just change something about it. I guess they held Bo in check. I remember they gave a couple of kick returns up that were really good for Texas. And so Texas ended up winning, and it was on CBS. Our next several games were not on TV, including big wins over Tennessee, Florida State, and Georgia Tech. And so the only game that the national audience had seen when we were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 but before we went to Florida, which was on CBS in October, we were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 1. But the only game the country had seen was us getting beat up by Texas. So that's why we were kind of lower ranked and didn't even climb up to number 3 until November 5th, was because all that people remembered... I remember people saying this later, that at the end of the season, none of the voters remembered Florida beating Miami, but everybody remembered Texas beating Auburn. And that's what ended up getting us, I think.
I think you're right, because again, we were on TV five times that year, including the bowl game.
Mm-hmm.
And the Texas game was a big early impression that stayed stuck in people's minds.
It stuck in people's minds. That's right. And Texas didn't lose until the Cotton Bowl. So anyway, we go to Tennessee, and that was an amazing. I remember a couple of things about that that game at Tennessee. That's a game where it was like the worst beating we gave them in Tennessee in a while. And that's the game where I think it was Trey Gaines in his freshman year. Yeah, or sophomore year. Trey Gaines, the little receiver, he caught a punt and went underneath two Tennessee tacklers and popped up and ran all the way back for a touchdown. It's one of those it's one of those things where when everything's going your way, sometimes everything goes your way, you know? And so we even scored a punt return for a touchdown in that game and just killed Tennessee 37-14. We had Florida State at home October 1st, and this is the game where Auburn went ahead late and Florida State was driving to take the lead at the end, or at least kick a field goal to tie it. Auburn was leading 27-24, and we had a great All-American linebacker that year who intercepted Florida State, I think in our end zone, and sealed the 27-24 win over Florida State, which moved us up to number 10. My girlfriend back then in high school.
Greg Carr.
Greg Carr loved him. That's right. She was in love with him. She had his jersey. Okay, we go to Kentucky. Now, here's the funny thing. I didn't mention this before. We beat Kentucky the year before in 82 by kicking six field goals, a feat we would not duplicate until, wasn't there a game a couple of years ago that we kicked like six field goals
yes.
in one? Okay. So, similar thing. We won by kicking six field goals. So, funny, we came back the next year in 83. We went to Kentucky and scored seven touchdowns and beat them 49-21. So, that was very satisfying. We go to Grant Field and beat Georgia Tech 31-13. And we beat Mississippi State. And we welcome in Florida, and oh, this was a great game, and it was on CBS. This should have helped us because Florida had beaten Miami, which should have been very important later, but it ended up not being. Miami had a loss. Number 5 Florida versus number 4 Auburn. That was a big Auburn-Florida game, and mm-hmm. this is one where Wayne Pease was Florida's quarterback. And that game went back and forth, back and forth. I think Bo had a couple of long runs in this game.
Campbell splits his tight end, Ed West, to the left. And flanked to the right is Buford. Campbell pitches the ball on a sweep to the short side. He broke the tackle. He's the 45, the 40. Jackson looks for running room. Hit from behind, got away. At the 25, he's in the foot race at the 20. To the 15, to the 10. Touchdown, Auburn!
You get excited if you want to, because I'm going to. What a great run by Bo Jackson.
And we end up winning 28-21. Fantastic game. Huge win. And then we don't get much of a break. On November 5th, in comes Maryland with Boomer Esiason, ranked number 7.
Auburn going with a prevent defense. They've got 5 defensive backs. Clock will go in motion at the snap of the ball from the Maryland 14, 13, 12. Esiason is hit. He drops the ball. Auburn falls on it in the end zone. Touchdown, Auburn! Donnie Humphrey, touchdown, Auburn! As Esiason was blindsided, knocked up the football, and big Donnie Humphrey, who played a marvelous defensive game, fell on the loose ball in the end zone, and Auburn leads 34-23.
And do you remember who the big star of this? This is a game between Boomer Esiason against Bo Jackson. And do you remember who the big star was in this game? If you don't remember, you'll never guess.
Was it Lionel James or Tommy Agee?
It was the Tommy Agee party. It was. Mm. The Maryland defense just keyed on Bo. It's like every snap, they just all jumped on Bo, whether he had the ball or not. And Agee just kept going up the middle for like 10 yards, 15 yards, 5 yards. He just ate them up, and they never would adjust. I remember the Mark and Brian. You may not have ever been around them, not being in Birmingham area, but there was these radio guys called Mark and Brian that were on the radio station in Birmingham. And they got to be very popular and went off to have a TV show on NBC or something later. But they started out, I even met one of them at a high school function, Mark Thompson. But they made so much fun of Bo every week. They had this little skit where they'd make fun of Bo. And that was the game where they said the crowd was cheering A.G., A.G., and they have their character Bo go, AG for always great. Always great Bo Jackson. I never forget that. So then we go, oh, man, I know you remember this one, John, because you were over in Georgia and you kept track of this rivalry. Auburn was number 3. Georgia was number 4. They had broken our hearts the year before with Herschel. We go over to Athens. Now, this was a Georgia team that had lost Herschel to the pros, but everybody else was back. I think even Buck Ballew, right? And this was a tough, tough Georgia team with a great defense. And this was a slugfest. And final score, 13-7. This ended their 3-year streak of SEC championships. And I remember those...
And the only game they lost that year.
Yes, and I remember those Georgia cheerleaders on the sideline crying, knowing they hadn't won the SEC championship all 4 years. That was a game of steel. That was a game for the ages. That was just trench warfare is what that game was. 13-7 between the number 3 and number 4 teams with great defenses, just smashing, is that a verb? Smash-mouthing in the trenches for 3 hours. And Auburn pulled it out. And I feel like if we hadn't won the SEC at that point, it was pretty much guaranteed we would, right? I mean, I think maybe if we lost to Alabama, we'd be 5-1. Georgia was 5-1, and we would tie, and we would have the tiebreaker. But we wanted to win it outright. So we go up to Birmingham, to Legion Field, to play Alabama, ranked number 3 in the country. This was the tornado game. There were tornadoes sighted all around Legion Field during this game. In fact, here's audio of Channel 6 in Birmingham trying to issue tornado warnings during a Bo Jackson long touchdown run and actually stopping momentarily to allow him to finish the touchdown before completing the tornado warnings.
Randy Campbell gives to Bo Jackson. Jackson's on his way.
This is Mary Brown from BRC6 Weather.
Goodbye.
Brown from BRC6 Weather. Tornado warnings expired for Tuscaloosa and Greene County, but now tornado warnings are in effect for Big, Perry, and Hale counties. Tornadoes have definitely been sighted. Residents should seek shelter immediately. I'll have details coming up.
And it was on ABC. Do you have any memories of this game?
Vaguely, did they stop the game because of the threat to public safety?
I feel like maybe at one point it was. I can't remember. I just remember there were, and I feel like at some point there was hardly anybody in the stands and they were playing the game. But ultimately, this is a game where Alabama really outplayed Auburn in most phases of the game. But Bo had a couple of long touchdown runs that made the difference, and we won 23-20. So second year in a row we beat Alabama. Second year in a row we scored 23 points and beat them. And so we stayed number 3. We were 10-1, SEC undisputed champions. And remember, there was no college football playoff. There was no BCS. There was nothing. This was the time of the bowl contracts, right? The
lock-in.
Yeah, the conferences had deals, and that's just where you went. And the voters, the AP and UPI, whoever coaches poll voters, had to decide comparatively after all bowl games had been played who was number 1, number 2, number 3 based on just their opinion because none of them really played each other. Now, let me give a little quick background on this. This is interesting. The SEC champion had to go to the Sugar Bowl. So we were going off to Louisiana Superdome, New Orleans, to play somebody. I think we got generally the runner-up in the Big Ten. The winner of the Big Ten was obligated to go to the Rose Bowl and play the winner of the Pac-10. So we would get the runner-up of the Big Ten, who that year was Michigan. I think Ohio State went off to the Rose Bowl that year. And so Michigan came down to the Sugar Bowl. And they were number 8 with a very good defense, very tough team. I mean, that was the year there were so many good teams that being 8 was nothing to sneeze at. They were good. And so this was a time, we were just entering a time now where the bowl games that were in the best position to have a national championship game were either the Orange Bowl or the Fiesta Bowl. And I feel like for most of the 80s, the Orange Bowl and the Fiesta Bowl decide the national championship. And here's why. The Fiesta Bowl did not have conference tie-ins, so they could take independent teams. And that meant the Fiesta Bowl was in a position to take Miami and or Notre Dame during those years that Miami and Notre Dame were really good in the 80s.
Penn State.
They could also take, yeah, teams from, they could take like runner-up teams from other conferences that didn't necessarily have an obligation. So, and the reason the Orange Bowl was in good position is the Orange Bowl would take the winner of the Big Eight, like Oklahoma.
Or Nebraska.
Or Nebraska. And then, but they would also take an at-large team, which meant they could get Miami or Notre Dame. You see what I mean? So,
yep.
The Orange Bowl could bring in a Nebraska or an Oklahoma and a Miami and have a absolute top-tier game, and they could bill it as a national championship game. It wasn't really, because there was no national championship game. But that's what happened this year. The Orange Bowl took Nebraska from the Big Eight champion, and they brought in Miami at large, and the Orange Bowl billed that as the national championship game. Meanwhile, Auburn is number three playing in the Sugar Bowl, and Texas is number two playing number four Georgia in the Cotton Bowl. So it really was a great semifinal round or quarterfinal round. It wasn't a national championship round at all, but it was the only thing we were going to get.
After an early loss to Texas, Auburn won nine games in a row, including seven against teams headed for bowls. The regular season came to a close last weekend against arch rival Alabama. Auburn prevailed 23-20 and is bound for the Sugar Bowl as the third-ranked team in the country. For the outstanding job Pat Dye has done holding the team together and finishing the toughest schedule in the nation at 10-1, Pat Dye has been named the 1983 NCAA Coach of the Year.
So Auburn kicks three field goals, Del Greco. Michigan did a good job of holding Bo Jackson in check. He didn't have, you know, a humongous amount of yards, but he ground out some tough yards. And Del Greco kicked the winning field goal at the end. We won 9-7. But Miami played the team of the century, Nebraska, with Mike Rozier, the Heisman Trophy winner, and Turner Gill, the quarterback, and that great defense and that great offensive line. And I think, what's his name, that great receiver played for him too, that went on to play for the Patriots forever.
Yes.
And so NBC was out there saying, oh, the winner of this game is a national champion, assuming Nebraska was going to win it probably. Well, you know, it comes down to the end, and Nebraska has to score to pull within one. Now, Tom Osborne can kick the extra point, tie the game. There's no overtime yet, not till 96. Osborne can kick the extra point, tie the game, and be national champions at 11-0-1. Actually, it would have been 12-0-1 because they won the kickoff classic against Penn State I mentioned a little while ago. So a 12-0-1 Nebraska would have been national champions over anybody else. But Osborne being Osborne, he's like, no, I want to win it outright. And they go for two, and you remember what happened?
They don't make it.
They don't make it. Miami knocked the pass down. So Miami won the Orange Bowl, and basically the media and Howard Schnellenberger, the coach, declare Miami are national champions. No doubt about it. It's done. Auburn is like, well, hold on a minute, because what happened in the Cotton Bowl? This is another really important part of this puzzle. Do you remember what
Georgia beat Texas?
Georgia beat Texas. And it came down to a play. I still remember this vividly. Georgia goes out to punt, and Texas assumes they're going for it, and it's fake. After the game, Fred Akers of Texas said, I never thought they'd actually kick it. I assumed they were going for it. So Texas put 11 men on the line of scrimmage, and Georgia punted it, and it just rolled all the way back to like the one-yard line before Texas recovered it. And then Georgia held them there, and I don't remember after that. They kicked a field goal. They scored a touchdown. They ran the clock out. Something. But in any case, Georgia pulled out a narrow win against Texas, which knocked another obstacle out of our way. We go into New Year's ranked third and number one lost and number two lost. Wouldn't you think number three would move up to number one if they won?
I would think so.
Would you think that number five, who lost to a team number three beat, they wouldn't jump all the way up to number one, would they?
Nope.
Guess what? Miami.
I think Ugh. And Miami did it. And I think the biggest thing was it didn't have to – and the media was part of it, but I think part of it was also that the Sugar Bowl was a defensive slugfest.
Yes.
9-7, and the Orange Bowl was a much more entertaining and exciting football game.
Yep. Yeah, and everybody was watching. They were on at the same time. That's another thing.
Yes.
They were on at the same time because the Sugar Bowl had kind of gotten spoiled that they'd had Alabama and Georgia for several years, and so everybody was watching them. So if the Orange Bowl is on at the same time, the Sugar Bowl is like, well, who cares? Everybody's going to watch our game anyway. We have Alabama. We have Georgia. You know, our game is always for the national championship. Well, lo and behold, the Orange Bowl gets all the viewers. This was still before widespread VCRs, much less DVRs. So people watched the Nebraska-Miami game and couldn't even see if they were watching it unless they had two televisions. We used to put two televisions out. Couldn't even see the Sugar Bowl. So, and also I only help that Schnellenberger says, we're number one, no doubt about it, for Miami. Pat Dye gives like a paragraph. Well, you know, if you look at the schedule we played and blah, blah, and this, that, and the other, and he rambles and rambles. I mean, you know, one is saying it's clear cut and the other is giving all this equivocation. I mean, I'm not blaming Pat Dye. I'm just saying he should have said we're number one.
That's it. Auburn played 9 bowl teams and 8 top 20 teams.
Unbelievable. Our schedule is so much tougher than Miami, it's not even funny. We were number 3, they were number 5. We beat the team that beat them. The teams ahead of us lost, and we played a much harder schedule. I mean, is the national championship an award for one day, or is it for a season? Because if it's for a season, I'm sorry, Miami. You played this one game that was admittedly great. Congratulations. You get the Orange Bowl trophy. You get to know you knocked off Nebraska. We went 11-1 against the hardest schedule in college football history. And the New York Times computer said, oh yeah, Auburn's number one. I mean, if we don't raise a banner in the stadium for this year before I'm dead, I'm going to haunt the athletic department for the rest of eternity. Alan Green, when he's 80 years old and still AD, he'll be sitting there at his desk and there'll be a voice behind him going, ooh, Alan, raise the banner, 83, ooh. And he'll be like, what is that?
The Plexico guy,
yeah. It is him, yeah. Get the exorcist in here. We got to get rid of it. All right, so 83 ends. And we all felt, this is what I mean, every silver lining has a dark lining to it, it seems like. We'd gone 11-1. We should have been filled with joy. And instead, we end this season frustrated again. We look back and we love this season and we love those players and coaches and everything, but my goodness, it's just a sour taste in your mouth again. So this was big frustration number one.
And especially, like, again, it wasn't just that we didn't win. It's just that Alabama and Georgia had just won national titles, and this happened to us.
Yeah. And guess what, Van and John in 1983? You better get ready because it won't be the last time. So that gets us to the end of the 82-83 seasons. On our next episode, we'll go forward with Bo coming back in 84 as a junior. Hope springs eternal. The defense is going to be great. Got a good, solid recruiting class coming in. And a little bit less frightening schedule, maybe. And so we go into 84 thinking, you know, we got a chance here. We might be the number one team in 84. We have a chance. Because Pat Dye had taken us in 2 years from 5-6 to feeling like we have a shot to be national champions. We got ripped off this year. Maybe we should have been national champions this year. But next year, hey, let's give it another shot, see what happens. So 1984, hope springs eternal again, and more weird stuff. In fact, we even get to start the season off in the Meadowlands against defending quote-unquote champion Miami in what we thought would be a game of we'll show them who should have been number one, even though we don't have Randy Campbell anymore. And once again, things don't go the way we want them to. They go the Auburn way, I'm afraid to say. So any last thoughts about 82 and 83 and what it felt like?
No, other than 83 really felt like a huge breakthrough and one of the greatest seasons in Auburn history.
Absolutely. And so we look at the bright side of it, absolutely. One of our great seasons. And it really showed that Pat Dye had made Auburn a force to be reckoned with and that this would be the decade of Auburn in the SEC.
If he knocks this through, he's got to be a prime MVP candidate, doesn't he?
Well, he's been there scoring.
Right. Well, I sort of feel that the inside running of AG is pretty spectacular.
Kind of surprised, too, Keith. Yeah. You gamble a little bit when you penetrate to stop the quarterback from getting outside. You're gambling that the fullback can't beat you. AG made two great runs on this drive, just individual effort.
Well, here it comes.
Here it is. Michigan will try to block it, in my judgment. They'll go after it all the way. It's up, and it's good.
Believed is a production of the AU Wishbone and White Rocket Entertainment in association with TheWarEagleReader.com. I'm Reynolds Wolf. The show was produced and engineered by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer and brought to you by all of our great supporters on Patreon.com. To join the AU Wishbone family, visit AUWishbone.com. War Eagle.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
This series is made possible because of our great supporters, our great patrons from the Auburn family, the AU Wishbone family, via Patreon.com. Our patrons get to hear these episodes weeks earlier than they are broadcast through our podcast feed via the Patreon site. You can join them for as little as a dollar a month and help to make these programs possible. Just go to www.auwishbone.com and click through to become a patron. As of this recording, we have to thank Brendan O'Dwyer, Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, Carl Von Drunker, Phil Amthor, Willie Carden, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Johnny Caldwell, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, Theodore Gary, Shannon Butson, Taylor, David Hegler, Mickey B, Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Dave Powell, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Raines, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Dave Medina, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, and our one-time and anonymous donors. Thank you guys all so much for making shows like this possible. John and I are having a ball creating it, and I hope that you're enjoying hearing it. And for as little as a dollar a month, you can keep them coming. So again, just go to www.auwishbone.com and become a patron. Join us next time for Episode 3 when we present Defense Auburn Defense, the Pat Dye Glory Years 1984 through 1988. War Eagle.